This is Vandana Shiva, and you're listening to the Enviro Show. Remember, listen to your mother.
Greetings, Earthlings. It's being the Enviro Show, I'm one of your co-hosts, Dio, and I'm not in the studio with...
Yes, I am being Glenn Ayers.
Right, Glenn. And a long time ago, we were advised to be here now, which is a Zen sort of thing. And where else would we be? With that in mind, Professor, naturalist, Buddhist author Christopher Eyes joins us for a look at green mental states. Hang on, stay tuned for that. Okay, more good news. Our critter of the week is appropriate for this time of year.
We all are animals. We all are animals.
Our critter of the week is a wild turkey, and they surely have flourished since their reintroduction to New England and beyond. Quote, once nearly wiped out and absent from more than half the U.S., wild turkeys have made an astonishing recovery. From just 200,000 birds in the 1930s to more than 7 million today, once extinct in 18 states, they now roam in 49, including many areas where they hadn't been seen in over 100 years. That's not just a comeback. It's one of the most successful wildlife recovery stories in the U.S. conservation history. Audubon points out, quote, while they may not look like the fastest birds, wild turkeys are surprisingly confident flyers capable of hitting 60 miles per hour. They are also more agile than they appear, close quote, which is a good thing since Thanksgiving is upon us, and given the tanking economy from his malignancy and company, some folks are thinking, DIY.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes people are referred to as turkeys, but in this case, you know, especially for celebration of, well, it depends on your definition of what Thanksgiving is really about.
Right.
But really, I think it is about the amazing resilience of forests and the critters. And the Europeans tried to wipe it all out.
Yeah.
And what is amazing is the ability of the forest to resist and recover and reestablish itself. And once that happens, then the conditions are perfect for the continued flourishing of all of those critters that were extirpated or wiped out through, you know, again, this wholesale war on wildlife that happened in this country. And yet those seeds existed, and now they are sprouting and growing and returning. And we're seeing that. We've seen that during our lifetimes. And we just need to work. We all need to work to continue to make that move in the right direction toward rewilding of much of nature that was subjugated. Because as the Bible claims, you know, man has dominion over nature. But really, the reality is that nature always bats last.
There it is. Okay, how about... I think our quote of the week is good in terms of who our guest is this week. So, quote, simply put, this historical moment calls for lifestyle change at the individual level and structural change at the societal level. We need this dual focus for it to call only for a reduction of our personal carbon footprints is to lay responsibility for causing and solving the problem at the feet of individuals, and thereby let our economic system and powerful players like the fossil fuel industry off the hook. Close quote, and that's from our guest, Christopher Ives.
Nice quote. Chris is, I'm going to just say, he's a deep thinker and he's also a man of action. I know him. I met him through Elders Climate Action, the group in Massachusetts here. He's very involved with that group. And also he participates on the Natural Solutions Working Group, a team of Elders Climate Action folks that have been meeting now pretty much every 2 weeks for the last couple of years. And, you know, we've been promoting the forest protection legislation and getting speakers in to educate the rest of the members of Elder Climate Action, as well as other groups, about the importance, the critical role that forests and the natural world plays in mitigating and addressing the climate emergency. And Chris approaches it from, you know, a deep, I don't know what to say, philosophical or spiritual level, the Zen part of it that he's going to talk about. And it really resonates with me because when we were in Earth First many years ago, we all espoused to a concept called deep ecology. Bill Duvall and Arnie Ness and those folks who were preaching essentially this way of interacting, this kind of social construct that treated nature as, I'm going to say, as a god or goddess. And we worship nature. And this, the Zen ecology that he's talking about is completely in line with all of those concepts and ideas that we really embraced back in the Earth First days. So Chris is a kindred spirit, and I haven't actually gone out and done any actions with him. He lives in the eastern part of the state. You know, we're out here in the western Connecticut River Valley area. But Chris definitely speaks my language, speaks our language, and I hope that folks enjoy this. And actually, we'll pick up his book, get a copy, and read it. It's very enjoyable read, and it sort of is perfect timing in that we need to have more reasons to be active. And if we can align our personal and spiritual beliefs with our activism, you know, that gives us a stronger foundation to work from. So check out this interview with Chris Ives. Today on the Enviro Show, we are joined by Chris Ives, and Chris is, I'm not sure, a retired professor, but we have him on the show because I interact with Chris in a group called Elders Climate Action, and we both happen to be elders. Well, all three of us, Dio included, are elders, and we're also activists. And we wanted Chris to come on the show to talk about a new book that he wrote and was recently published called Zen Ecology. And the tie-in for Dio and myself is that we were previously, not in a previous life, but earlier in our activist careers, we were very involved with Earth First. And Earth First was based on this concept of deep ecology. And the book that Chris has written, to me, is in this very same vein as the book by Bill Duvall, which we kind of had as a Bible in Earth First, which was called Simple in Means, Rich in Ends. And then also the book Deep Ecology by Arnie Ness. And a bunch of other similar writings. Dolores LaChapelle was a favorite of mine, and several others. So, Chris, it really is a pleasure to have you as a guest on the Enviro Show. And you certainly can do a better introduction of yourself than I did. But tell our listeners about you and your career, and also about your activism and this new book, Zen Ecology.
Well, thank you, Glenn. It's a pleasure to be with you on your show today in this podcast. I really appreciate your inviting me. And this book, in many ways, pulls from my more academic work. I just retired from Stonehill College, and my focus was Buddhist studies. When I was an undergraduate out at Williams College here in Massachusetts, I became interested in Zen Buddhism, and this is in the early 1970s. And though I was thinking I was going to become a therapist, I wanted to go to Japan and practice Zen. And that ultimately launched me on, after 5 years in Japan, graduate work in Claremont, California. And then I taught for about 15 years up at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington, and then at Stonehill since 2002. And most of my work as a scholar, a teacher scholar, has been on Zen Buddhist ethics. And a lot of my more academic writings have focused on that topic, especially modern Zen and ethics. My last academic book was on Zen Buddhist nationalism in Japan during World War II. And then after I published that book, that was in 2009, I was in my late 50s, and I was a tenured professor. I had lots of articles and other things going, and I didn't necessarily need to keep writing academic books. I wasn't in a publisher parish kind of situation. And so I started writing a couple of books, in part for myself and in part for a broader audience, an audience broader than, who knows, the five people in my field that might read my academic publications. And I had grown up in rural Connecticut and spent a lot of time in the woods as a kid, hiking. My dad was the local scoutmaster. And at one point, I decided to write a book that would clarify for me how scampering in the woods of Connecticut, enduring the pain of long hikes, getting banged up in the woods, enjoying the beauty of nature, might have predisposed me to be open to or resonant with the Zen Buddhist tradition and a lot of the aesthetic traditions that surround that. And then, contrary wise, I was curious after years of studying Zen here and in Japan, practicing Zen in one of the monasteries there for a couple of years, and then practicing back here in the US, how might my Zen practice have colored the ways in which I hike and backpack and spend time in the woods? And so, thinking about that, I published a book about 10 years ago called Zen on the Trail: Hiking is Pilgrimage. And part of that book gets at how there are ways of being in the woods, and this may be something that a lot of your listeners can resonate with, ways of being in nature that overcome that felt sense of separation from nature. And that's one theme in the Zen on the Trail book. It's kind of a spirituality of hiking with a Zen Buddhist coloring. And then after writing that, which kind of clarified for me, the growing up in New England predisposing me to resonate with Zen and my practice of Zen coloring how I spend time in the woods, I also found myself wanting to write a book in part to clarify for myself at this very complex moment, not just the climate crisis, but political violence and different things happening in this society and beyond. A book that would help me get clear about how I can live in this moment, facing the climate crisis in particular. And so Zen on the Trail led to this book, Zen Ecology. And the subtitle of Zen Ecology is Green and Engaged Living in Response to the Climate Crisis. And what I was doing there, and again, writing this book for me, and it's not very academic, there's some good meat in there, but it's not an academic piece. But I wrote it to clarify for myself how, Buddhist resources might help me live in an ethical green way now at two levels. The green part of the subtitle, Green Living, I'm thinking about lifestyle change, Buddhist resources for living simply, lowering one's carbon footprint, and doing it in a way that is not deprivation. I think some people think that, if I really want to live ethically and ecologically, I'll never eat meat again, I'll never travel again, I'll have no air conditioning in the summer, I'll have to sell my car and only use public transportation. And maybe that is part of it, but I think there are ways of simplifying our lives, especially in community with others, that are actually more fulfilling than the normal consumerist, materialist rat race. And so part of the book is looking at, taking action to green one's lifestyle and using Buddhist input to do that in a way that's not miserable self-sacrifice, like, no meat, no air conditioning, no fun, I'm miserable. But hey, if I want to be moral, if I want to serve the planet or the common good, I do have to sacrifice my own happiness on the altar of doing the right thing. And what I'm trying to do is, drawing from Buddhism, but you could draw from other traditions. I mean, Christian monasticism is another template for simple and fulfilling living. And the other focus of the book, the engaged part of the subtitle, Engaged Living, is thinking about not just greening our lifestyle. As many of us know, that's not sufficient. I mean, it's great if we can all drive electric cars or go vegan or whatever. But in terms of the causes and the continuation of the climate crisis, as you well know, we also need to address structural issues, you know, dominant economic paradigms, the growth paradigm, the power of the fossil fuel industry, Supreme Court decisions like Citizens United, lobbying state government to make, you know, EV charging stations more available, or setting up some kind of carbon fee and dividend program, whatever that might be. In terms of working on the book, thinking about activism at that level, that is not Buddhism's strong suit. You know, when it comes to the individual level and lifestyle change, the original Buddhist path, even though the Buddha 2,500 years ago didn't set that up as a template for green living, he set it up as a way to deal with emotional existential anguish, you know, what Buddhists call dukkha or suffering. But that early Buddhist spiritual path with a lot of values around restraint, generosity, non-harming, contentment, simplicity, mindfulness, insight, all of those values that, you know, were cultivated through traditional Buddhist practices, yeah, we're serving spiritual transformation, but do provide at the very least a kind of environmental virtue ethic or different guidelines for simple living. And so in some ways, lifestyle change, greening one's lifestyle in a way that's actually more fulfilling, not less fulfilling, that's the low-hanging fruit in a sense for Buddhism and environmental ethics or Buddhism and environmental issues. The trickier issue is activism, whether it's protesting, lobbying, getting arrested, doing more radical actions aimed at structural change. Again, trying to get campaign finance reform, rolling back Citizens United, whatever it might be, a carbon tax. And there's fewer resources in Buddhism because historically in Asia, Buddhism hasn't had that prophetic critique you see in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that impetus to speak truth to power, to hold those in power accountable, point out their hypocrisy. Buddhism, through most of Asian history, has had a very symbiotic relationship with ruling powers, a kind of you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And so you don't have a lot of historical examples of Buddhists, you know, stepping forth, challenging those in power, maybe, you know, getting arrested or worse. But the tradition does offer resources for directing people toward activism, supporting that activism, maybe directing it in certain ways. And that's what I tried to work with. There was a little bit more sort of intellectual labor in pulling that together in the later sections of the book. But basically, yeah, those are the two main foci of the book. A question I was asking for myself and maybe other people who might be interested in Buddhism, who are Buddhists, or just simply trying to get pointers for, again, taking action in the form of lifestyle change and taking action in the sense of, you know, more full-on activism directed towards structural change.
Chris, I'm a big fan of Henry David Thoreau. Thoreau said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." And so that's kind of the concept that I'm thinking of when I read your book, but maybe I'm bringing my own viewpoint into interpreting, you know, what you're presenting. But I think I'm in sync with what you're talking about. And that is that we need to, yes, we need to pay attention to ourselves, but we also exist in a bigger community. And we need to sometimes expand our efforts into that community and get together with others. And that's something that I find very rewarding of being involved with Elders Climate Action. Mm-hmm. And where I met you is that the people involved there, they're all people who want to work with others to bring about system change or systematic change. And so how do we go about that? How do we do that balance? How do we, you know, devote ourselves to something? And what are the rewards?
A lot of richness in what you were just talking about, Glenn. Let me just dive in there. In part, what you were talking about in terms of the Earth First deep ecology approach, you know, helping people realize that we're woven into nature as opposed to here indoors in human culture with nature and all the other than human animals over there or out there. On the one hand, Buddhism avoids the kind of, you know, humans are holding dominion over the rest of nature. Now that can be interpreted in different ways out of the book of Genesis in the Bible. But, you know, Buddhism doesn't necessarily have that hierarchy. You can find elements of it in terms of who can become enlightened and all. But at another level, Buddhism has a kind of biocentric equality, to use a term coming out of deep ecology, with other than human species, insofar as we're all sentient beings, we all can suffer, and hence we're all on the path to awakening. Now, granted, there is a bit of hierarchy. It might be, you know, most forms of Buddhism say chickens and roosters and grizzly bears need to be reborn in a human form to attain enlightenment and break out of the pain of rebirth. But at the same time, it provides a Buddhist basis, you know, maybe parallel to certain indigenous views, where other than human animals can be seen as kindred spirits on the path, maybe even going, you know, another step further. And, you know, I don't want to do any cultural appropriation here, but in terms of indigenous traditions talking about all my relations, that sense of having kinship with other than human beings and and existing with them with reverence, with respect, with responsibility, with reciprocity, Buddhism really lends itself to that kind of view. But unfortunately, Buddhism historically hasn't spent a lot of time really drilling down into the sentience of animals. What is the nature of their sentience as sentient beings? Is it just the ability to feel pain and pleasure? Or might they have certain moral impulses, concern for others, maybe certain hopes and aspirations as they try to reach their full potential or whatever? And I touch upon that in the book as well. And I'll just say, in both of those respects, you know, realizing our embeddedness in nature, you know, a lot of Buddhists will talk about certain, you know, peak experiences in Buddhism, sort of becoming one with nature and that sense of separation dropping off and saying, oh, this is a great resource. But maybe those experiences for a lot of us are, you know, few and far between and may not change our behavior. And in some ways, you know, I resonate with the poet Gary Snyder talking about re-inhabitation and committing to place and knowing the geological history, knowing the indigenous history. If you're here in North America on Turtle Island, you know, the indigenous history before colonial settlers came in and committed genocide and in many cases stole the land. And what have they done? What's the flora and fauna? How does the hydrological cycle work through my little piece of the planet, in my watershed, in my bioregion? And I think that's a great resource too, for helping people not just having moments of realizing they're interconnected with nature, but really embracing that. Maybe realizing that in two senses, realizing their embeddedness, not in the sense of realizing like having an aha moment and a realization, but also realizing the sense of actualizing. Like when we talk about someone realizing their potential or realizing goals, how can we put into practice with our bodies that commitment to place based on a knowledge of that place, which could lead to a love for that place, which can then lead to taking action to protect it. And so, yeah, to come around to the last part of what you were saying, Glenn, I think some of these resources are not only spiritually beneficial, overcoming that sense of separation and being stuck in your little ego, but also provide a basis for sustained, for example, climate activism. You know, if we can really realize a deep intimacy with the biosphere, realize how we're woven into it, identify with that eco-self, that eco-awareness, out of that will come concern and care and caring. Buddhists talk a lot about compassion, and sometimes people think compassion is just empathy, you know, calm passion, feeling the pain of others. But compassion in a lot of Buddhist texts is not just caring about something, like caring about someone's suffering, but caring for, taking action to protect or to nurture. And in that sense, the kind of love that can come out of these feelings, these experiences of realizing how we are always embedded in nature, can lead to that knowledge and intimacy of place, which leads to love of place, compassion for it, which can then lead to taking action. And that may in part be, love for other than human beings. I find it personally, I don't know about you, really sad that when we hear about the damage done by whatever it might be, recent fires in California or whatever, we always hear about the property damage and the loss of human life or the number of human injuries. And that's obviously hugely important. But I've always wanted, some sort of number saying also in these fires in Altadena, California in January, roughly they estimate 10,000 sparrows died, probably, several million mice. It'd be nice to have that data on other beings who are suffering because of human greed and what we're doing to our planet.
Chris, Dio here. This is amazing. You've got me thinking all kinds of things, but since we're running low on time, I just wanted to sort of, I definitely agree with you about sort of inherent awareness of nature. And I, of course, think of children when I think of green mental states. A lot of children just seem to have that naturally in the they're poking around in their yard or whatever, and they lose that, which is a
That's true.
sad thing. But thanks for that. I guess I would like to ask how we can get people to reach that point, get back to that point in their lives, but we don't have the time, I guess.
Yeah,
But
or just to speak briefly to that, I think in part, what you're talking about is, the awe and wonder that kids have, for various reasons, whether it's science or industrialization. In recent centuries, the world's gotten disenchanted. And I'm not gonna, I don't personally make any kind of, arguments about we need to be open to the existence of fairies or elves or trolls or, re-enchant nature with, certain spirits. That's not my worldview. But at the very least, we can perhaps recapture some of that joy and wonder. And in many cases, it's just simply getting outside and spending time outdoors. And really paying attention to the beauty and to the magic of what's happening there in the changing seasons, or salmon going upstream, or ants, in a line bringing food back to the anthill. How can we re-enchant the world for ourselves, at least in terms of awe, wonder, and joy? And in some cases, certain types of contemplative practices can help with that. And maybe that's part of it too. I mean, we are much more committed to protecting that which we love than simply that which we think we should protect. And just to close, I'm recalling when I was teaching at the University of Puget Sound in a discussion with a person who was kind of a extreme rationalist. And I think he may have been taking that stance just for the sake of debate. And we were talking about environmental concern. And he was really pushing rationalism and poo-pooing religion and states like awe and wonder as being too touchy-feely or whatever. And what I said to him, and it's relevant to your podcast and to the Enviro show, what I said to him was, but I bet, for every person who becomes an environmentalist by using their rationality to crunch numbers about parts per million in the atmosphere or rising sea levels or species, decline of biodiversity, I said, for every one person who uses their rationality to become an environmentalist, I would wager there are 10 people who become environmentalists by having powerful experiences out in nature, whether it's of beauty or that feeling of awe and wonder and the magic of nature, even without elves and fairies and spirits, just simply nature doing its thing is beautiful and amazing and awe-inspiring. And so, And obviously, once you've become committed through your aesthetic experience or that joy and wonder, obviously rationality has its place where you look at pieces of legislation in the state legislature, like, Glenn and I do with Elders Climate Action, or, crunching numbers and figuring out, okay, out of my love of nature, what is the most effective action that I can take? Let me do some homework, use my rationality to get a handle on it, and then take action.
Right.
Well, we've been talking with Chris Ives about all kinds of things, but we're specifically doing this interview to talk about your book, Zen Ecology. And I'm just going to say that I've really enjoyed reading it. I'm not quite done. And it is very accessible. It is not written in academic,
Jargon.
difficult to comprehend jargon. Yes, it is very accessible. And I would encourage folks, would make a great read for yourself or for a loved one as a holiday gift. And it's available even now in used bookstores. It's been out long enough that if you do a Google search for it, you'll find it available out in for many booksellers. So, Chris, I really want to thank you for being on the show. And for our listeners, we're going to link to a talk that you recently did for Elders Climate Action, a deep dialogue that's maybe an hour and a half long if folks want a little more to get into this a little deeper. And there was more of a conversation there. And then we'll continue to talk about, how we can interact with nature in a meaningful and mindful way. And
Yes.
I think that your writing is really instrumental. And I'll say one more thing before we sign off, and that is that you mentioned, I believe, it was a recent meeting that we were in Elders Climate Action, a book by Chet Ramo called The Path. And I picked up a copy of that for a couple of bucks. And it's a wonderful book to read. And I think he was also a professor at Stonehill. Is that correct?
Yes, he was, exactly.
And so there's another connection. And that is, to me, that's a very Zen book. He really pays attention to this 1 mile walk that he does and brings in the historical aspects of it and the ecology. And it's really a classic, I would say. Not having ever heard about it before and reading it, I can see that it is a classic book. So anyway, that's The Path by Chet Ramo.
Glenn, if I could just interrupt, I know we're running out of time, but in my teaching at Stonehill College, I would pair that book with Gary Snyder's essay, Reinhabitation, and see
Excellent.
that book as someone who is really paying attention to his place. As you were just saying, the geology, the flora and the fauna, the history. And so, yeah, it'd be a great book to read in conjunction with Gary Snyder's essay. And if people Google Reinhabitation Gary Snyder, they can find a PDF of the essay. It's only about, I don't know, 12 or 14 pages.
Well, again, Chris, thanks so much for being on the show
Yes.
and for your activism and for your efforts to, it spread enlightenment throughout the community. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's great what you're doing, and I'm really pleased to be part of it, and I feel honored to be part of your show because you do amazing things through your show and making a big impact, and I appreciate being part of it.
That's about it. I can't think of anything else except remember.
Listen to your mother.
Exactly. This is Dio saying adios.
And I'm Glenn Ayers, happy to be here, and take care, folks.
I am Mother Earth, and I approve of this message.